welcome once again to Women's Voices. My guest this evening is Nancy Flanagan, an educational writer and consultant focusing on teacher leadership. She was 30 years in the classroom teaching K through 12 instrumental and vocal music and math, and was Michigan Teacher of the Year in 1993. Nancy is a National Board Certified Teacher, and she e-mentored novice and alternative certification teachers for three universities, an education nonprofit, a major national corporation supporting career change teachers, and a state teachers association. She supported candidates for National Board Certification and coached National Board Certified Teachers' leading site-based professional learning projects, online professional learning, math and science, education policy. She is co-founder and part of the executive committee for the Network of Michigan Educators. Nancy co-created and piloted the innovative course, Leading Virtual Communities in Education. Nancy's blog is Teacher in a Strange Land. Please stay with us as Nancy Flanagan discusses the challenging world of today facing dedicated and mostly women teachers and their students. And before that, we're going to listen to They Are Innocent from my CD, Okwaka Speaks, the Words and Music of Mother God.
Wake up, all my
Welcome, Nancy, to Women's Voices.
Well, what a pleasure it is to be here. I'm still kind of stuck in the music there. What a great selection.
Thank you.
There's no occasion that is not improved by music.
Isn't that true?
Well,
absolutely.
Of course, I'm supposed to say that because I'm a music teacher, but that was lovely. Thanks.
Thank you so much. It's one of my favorites. Well, it's nice to have you. I know you're on a different time there. It's 3 hours later in Michigan, so
yeah.
I appreciate your staying up.
Oh, again, it's a great pleasure.
You know, my first question is, given that this is Women's Voices, is what part did your own mother play in the woman that you are today?
What a great question. I'll bet you get a lot of really interesting answers.
I do.
In asking that, well, my mom was a post-war bride and wanted the things that a lot of young women wanted in the 40s and 50s to, you know, have a family. And she was not an enormous influence on me at first. My dad was the person who, you know, controlled the family and decided things. And my mom always seemed to me to be kind of the second in command or riding shotgun on all of his decisions. But she lost her husband, my dad, early when she was in her 40s. And then she became a completely different person. She stepped up and, you know, still had children at home. And so she became this amazing role model, kind of out under the shadow and making decisions. And she was a great mother. And I can't, you know, losing my dad at an early age was a difficult thing, but it was wonderful to see her step up, and there was a core strength. My mom never had real high ambitions for me. As a matter of fact, when I was in high school, she thought I should become a hairdresser. Yes, and because she had a friend who was a hairdresser who had a shampoo bowl and a chair in her basement, and my mother's theory was, well, you know, when you have children, as you undoubtedly will, you know, you'll get married and have children, and so you can always cut hair on Saturdays. And I had no intention of doing that. You know, I thought that was really, really pretty awful, but neither of my parents was really excited about me going to college. That wasn't really on their agenda at all. And but I wanted to very much because I was a musician and I wanted to study music in college. And eventually I kind of talked them into it. And you hear stories all the time, or at least I do, from other teachers who say, I've always wanted to be a teacher since I was a little girl, and I would line my stuffed animals up and teach them. And that was never me. I didn't really care about teaching my stuffed animals. but I did want to play music professionally, and so I went to college to study music, and with my mother's blessing, eventually. And she got over her dreams of me going to beauty school and accepted that I wanted to be a musician.
You must have taken flute lessons, and you must have flourished doing that.
Yeah, I did. And actually, that was a sacrifice for my parents, but it was really important to my dad because my dad did not finish high school, and but he continued to, even after he dropped out, he continued to go to school last hour of the day to play in the band until they kind of caught wind of the fact that he was no longer a student there and told him, no, you have to be in school all day. But he was very anxious for me to play a musical instrument, and because he did, and he loved it so much. So, as a matter of fact, when I was in high school, I was studying at the local university, and the professor who was my teacher told my parents that I needed a new flute, and I can picture it in my mind right now, standing outside the professor's office, and he's talking to my parents and saying, this flute she has, it's just a student flute, it's not good enough, she's going to need a flute for the rest of her life, and my dad saying, how much, and it was a lot, way more than they had. And that night when I came home and went to bed, I could hear my parents in the kitchen with cups of coffee and talking about, how are we going to do this? And so they remortgaged their house and bought a flute for me.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. I still have it. I've taken that flute everywhere. I've taken it Europe, up in the mountains, and played at both of their funerals and countless weddings, and it was just this wonderful, wonderful gift.
Indeed. Indeed. What a wonderful gift. Wow. So I imagine your being a music teacher came out of your own love of music.
Yes. Yes. I actually did not intend to teach music. I wanted to play professionally. There are not lots of jobs and symphonies, so for a while I was working in a drugstore and trying to find a symphony job playing auditions, and I thought, well, maybe I could substitute teach, and so I went to the local school, and they said, oh yeah. So I spent a year paying the rent by substitute teaching everything from kindergarten to chemistry, and it turned out that I really liked it. I loved it, in fact, so I had to go back and get a teaching certificate, but once I made that discovery, I taught music for the rest of my career.
So you found your spot.
I did, kind of by accident, but it worked.
Yes. You taught seventh grade for 17 years at the Heartland Farms Middle School as a band and vocal teacher?
I taught sixth, seventh, and eighth grade most of that time. In the 30 years that I taught school, it was mostly music, but in a small school district, you're often called on to, oh, we need someone to teach a section of seventh grade math, or I taught English as a second language for an hour a day 1 year, and it was But it was mostly music.
And you began a program that began with a dozen kids to one that you had hundreds.
Yeah.
And you put on, you had 325 students and put on 25 performances a year.
Yeah.
That's amazing. This is a small community, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, more than half of the kids in the school were in the band program. And
that's astonishing.
Yeah. Well, it just kept kind of growing and growing, and we kept doing more things. And the amazing thing about teaching kids, especially middle grades kids, is that every time you raise the hoop, they jump a little bit higher with you. And I had a wonderful career, and I was lucky to be able to leave while I loved it. Today I hear a lot of teachers talking about, I used to like teaching, but I don't like it anymore, and I'm just waiting to retire, or I'm going to try to figure a way to get out. And that never happened for me. I liked it as much at the end as I did the first day. And I know that I'm fortunate.
Well, you probably also stopped before it was so crazy as it is now.
Yeah, I've been retired for 5 years, and you could kind of see the dark cloud on the horizon when I left. Indeed.
And along the way, did you get your national board certification?
Yes. I did that in 1999, I believe, yes.
So you've been quite an innovator. You've done lots and lots of different things besides the 30 years teaching.
And that's what I think why I liked it so much. It was fresh every year. I never taught the same year twice. You know, it was always something new and challenging. And again, I think it's harder to do that now. I think there's a lot more control over teachers' professional work. And some of that is okay, but a lot of teachers have lost the ability to create, the ability to innovate. They've lost autonomy over their work, the core of what teaching is, and that's a terrible loss. We're going to be paying for that for decades.
Yes, it is. I've, listened and looked at much of your material, and I think I saw a video, and this male teacher was saying how sad it was that he couldn't, because he was forced to do all these other things and the testing and all of that. It didn't leave room for him to be a teacher.
Yeah, and the thing is, the teacher in the classroom in any school, be it a traditional public school or a private school or preschool, the teacher is the person who is best positioned to decide how to teach something and whether to reteach something and when to assess and what the assessments tell them. And it's professional judgment, and it takes a long time to develop that. You don't have that when you come out of college and start teaching. And then just as you start to really get a handle on how to diagnose learning problems and how to design amazing lessons, all that's gone. The control over teachers' core work, instruction and curriculum and assessment and really knowing students, that's fading. That's being yanked away.
And I suppose larger classes, too, make a...
Yeah, larger classes. Well, you're talking to somebody here, you realize, who I had classes that were 65, 70, 75, and in one horrible year, 93 first hour class. It's just me and 93 eighth graders with noisemakers.
I can't believe it. In Michigan.
Well, yeah. Yes, but class size, it is huge. I mean, for teachers who are, reading students writing or teaching kids to read or how to do algebra, and class size matters greatly.
It's horrific, really. I'm going to just say that you are listening to Women's Voices. I'm Janie Reisner, and my guest this evening is Nancy Flanagan, an educational writer and consultant focusing on teacher leadership, who's been teaching for 30 years. You talked about, when we chatted, about the role of women and men, and that most teachers are women.
Yeah.
And who makes the decisions above them are men.
Yeah. Yeah, the vast majority of policymakers and the people who are speaking about policy are largely male. If you look at, for example, education bloggers, they run about 3-1, male to female. And the men are blogging mostly about technology and policy, and the women are blogging about what they do in their classroom. Today we did this, or here's an idea that worked for me. And so the women are focusing on practice. That's not hard and fast, of course, but that's the way it seems to be happening. And in the 60s, women were getting more secondary positions, and it seemed to be a really great thing. There were, more men coming into elementary classrooms, which I think is good. But recently, there's been a real imbalance. I think the fact that women are now almost 4-1, the ratio of women to men, I think that impacts a lot of the way the decisions are made. For example, in Michigan, Michigan is it's the home of the auto industry and a flagship union state, and last December, the Michigan legislature passed legislation changing Michigan from a union state to a right-to-work state, but not for police and firefighters. They were given a pass, and the governor said, well, police and firefighters, they need to have unions. They need to have that bonding. But teachers, they don't need unions. It's no good for them to have unions. It's like, what? And I think that's, again, because teachers' unions are largely female, and it's an easier push, I think, to control that.
That's too bad. It means then that the feminine point of view, the whatever we want to call that, doesn't get a voice.
Yeah. That's really exactly what it means, and it means
even though they're the ones doing the teaching.
Yeah, they are, by and large, and also doing a lot of the things that teachers have to do about knowing kids well and nurturing kids, and bringing a dry pair of pants for that first grader who has an accident, and the men I know who are elementary school teachers talk about the negatives for them too, that it's very difficult for a man to teach second grade because there's always suspicion about why would a man be teaching second grade, and the imbalance is hard on men and hard on women and hard on kids not to see male and female role models across the board from kindergarten into high school.
Yes, I know my children, and this was quite a long time ago, there were many men teaching, and they had, bonded with a number of them. They were important in their lives, the science teacher, for instance. It's a loss all the way around.
It is. Yeah, that it was the same for my children too, and again, the data on that's pretty clear. We're moving toward an increasingly female teaching force, and I do think that has something to do with the way the strength and comprehensive nature of education policy in the last decade. Men just don't want to be, they you know, told what to do.
They don't want to be in that position.
Right.
When we say the people on top, what are we talking about, superintendents or?
Well, I'm talking mostly about policymakers. And policymaking, you know, it's not just the legislature anymore. One of the big sweeping changes in education that I have seen, you know, as a person who started teaching in the early 70s, is the fingerprint of federal policy on teaching. Now, when you say policy, people's eyes kind of glaze over, you know. It's like nobody wants to talk about education policy, but the decisions are now being made at the federal level. The Race to the Top, for example, was a federal competitive grant program that changed education dramatically in every state in the country. That was unheard of before that. Education has always been a local control thing, and that's not the case anymore.
Teachers and probably students and parents, too, are objecting to this, and there's been all sorts of things going on in strikes and walkouts and protests.
Yes, it's been a long time coming, and I'm happy to see it just for awareness. I think we are actually in danger of losing public education. Public education is one of America's best ideas. One of the things that, you know, built citizenship back in the days when there were waves of immigration, and it's, you know, the old melting pot idea, and it was there as an opportunity for anyone who was ambitious and smart could make a go of it with a public education. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the GI Bill, which was public funding to send, returning veterans to college education. I know that jump-started the economy for decades. And those are all, the colleges and universities and the K-12 schools that were built by in the baby boom, and that is endangered now. And it's hard to see that if you're in a relatively affluent area where the public schools are still pretty good and, you know, parents are generally happy. But there's an encroaching worry that the way policy is being created, the things that we treasured the most, we're in danger of losing them.
I read it someplace that in response to President Obama's recent speech, maybe it was State of the Union, talking about teachers and students and education, and I've forgotten what he said, but it was, I know the response was that he certainly didn't check in with any teachers to see. I think it was... was probably, you know, excelling, and if they didn't, I don't know what would happen to them.
I've heard a lot of the president's speeches and a lot of the Secretary of Education's speeches, and the Secretary of Education is prone to sports analogies and sports metaphors, and he's always talking about racing to the top and the same goalposts and a very competitive approach to education. You know, we must compete, and I'm not sure, you know, we're a very creative and innovative and economically successful nation, and we're not falling behind. There are things that we could do to make our public education system much better, and it does have a lot to do with teachers. And the president, in both of his last two State of the Union speeches, has said nice things about teachers. He called teachers nation builders 2 years ago, and, you know, who doesn't want to hear that? That's great. But, on the other hand, he turns around and talks about Teach for America, a program that puts people in the classroom with 5 weeks of training. So clearly he's not listening to veteran teachers. I'm disappointed in education policy. And I actually think the 2008 election was a real turning point for a lot of public school advocates. I think they thought, well, now we have someone in the White House who understands the importance of public education, a 21st century education. We're going to stop all of this testing, you know, this negative testing and negative uses of data to compare schools. We're going to, you know, get back on the track toward innovation and creativity, and that did not happen. And it was a big surprise to a lot of progressive educators.
Well, then there's Ron Emanuel in Chicago and all of that. Could you talk about the protests? There's Newark, New Jersey, and Detroit, and Seattle.
They're kind of bubbling up, and they're a little different every place. Of course, in Seattle, it was a very strong veteran group of teachers at Garfield High School who just decided they were not going to give this test. And it appears that they have not suffered and will not suffer any negative consequences from that. There was a little talk of, you know, the principal saying, you know, your employment could be in jeopardy, but that went away. And I think that was a victory for the teachers there and for teachers everywhere. I hope it gives other people courage to do that. And it takes, a veteran staff with protections for people. New young teachers are not known for bold steps like that because they want to keep their jobs.
Sure.
So it happened in the right place, and it was handled beautifully. There, Jesse Hagopian, who was one of the leaders of that, did a workshop, and I was there, and he talked about how the teachers in the school got together and said, okay, if we're not going to give these tests, what can we tell the parents and our community about how we're assessing students? If we're not using these, you know, expensive computer-based standardized tests that don't tell us what we need to know, what is it that we do need to know? What are we going to do? And they met on their own in small groups and prepared, you know, a template explaining to people how students were going to be assessed. And again, that's teachers' work. That's the kind of work teachers should be doing. They should be talking about how are we going to assess our students, not having it come in from the outside, you know, and just be imposed on them. Of all of the places where there are protests, I probably know the most about Detroit. And Detroit's, it's terrible what's happened here. And the teachers here are not as well prepared, and the scale of the problem is huge. But they have lost the lowest 5% of school districts based, again, on test scores are in the process right now in Michigan of losing their contracts. Their elected school boards are disenfranchised, and the governor is sending emergency managers under the Education Achievement Authority that are coming in, and they're just this means a local district can't hire its own superintendent, can't elect its own board, can't decide how to spend its own tax dollars.
It's terrible.
Yeah, it is. It's whatever happened to democracy. And
that's a good question.
It is frightening. And I think the people in Michigan have let it happen because Detroit has been, a city in trouble for a long, long time, for decades. You know, it's just rampant unemployment, and when the auto industry basically pulled the resources out of the city and left, the schools were more or less abandoned. There were at one time 165,000 students in K-12 schools. In the year 2000, in fact, and in the next school year, they're thinking there will be about 35,000.
Well, where did the what happens to those children? Where do they go? Or
yeah, that's a good question. Some of them left the city, but not most of them. Many of them went to charter schools.
If they could afford, now that costs money, doesn't it?
Charter schools in Michigan get the same per pupil amount from the state.
Mm-hmm.
So as the school right next to it. So, and you know, there are a handful of really good charter schools in Detroit, and there are many terrible charter schools and many kids who go from one school to another, looking for a place. And what's left in public schools is mostly kids whose parents can't provide transportation or uniforms or have the savvy to compare one school to another. So,
and the children are the losers.
And the children are the losers. There are lots of kids in Detroit who are just unaccounted for.
Mm. I read someplace just recently about the plan is to just simply wipe out the infrastructure of everything, you know, of education, of healthcare. I mean,
yeah.
So we're just being dumbed down, and
yeah,
it's not a good scene.
It's not. I don't know whether that's the plan. There's a whole group of people who think that see it as a kind of broad-based conspiracy to corporatize, to privatize public education. And there's a lot to suggest that that's true, because it's a huge untapped market that has belonged in the public sector for a long, long time. And so anybody who wants to be an entrepreneur and you know, hard to say something negative about someone who wants to create a school that will help kids who are poor and don't have a lot to bring to the table. But it's kind of the Wild West.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a handful of these are high quality schools, and they're, you know, doing good things for kids. But the majority of these schools are not. They're just someone's
idea of
right.
Oh, I think I'll make a school.
I think I'll have a school. Yeah.
Wow. Excuse me. I am just speaking with, this is Women's Voices. I'm Janie Reisner, and I'm here with my guest, Nancy Flanagan from Michigan. Some senator or representative who wanted to, if their children were not doing well in school, they'd lose 30% of their.
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Get bad grades, no food for you. That's happened in Tennessee and in Florida. There have been there's legislation proposed.
Uh-huh.
I don't think it's passed either place. That in Tennessee it was unless students did well on standardized tests or, you know, achieved at a certain level, they would take 30% of their parents'. You know, family welfare benefits.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. It's beyond comprehension.
It
really
is. It's Dickensian. I mean,
right. The whole mess. It's just a terrible mess. Let's face it.
Yeah.
The woman in Chicago seemed to be quite amazing. Who she stood toe to toe with Ron Emanuel.
Yes, Karen Lewis, the CTU president, and who was a chemistry teacher, and just a. Again, a veteran teacher, someone who had seen some tough situations in teaching and had built a real following among, you know, her colleagues and parents. You know, and that's what makes Karen Lewis so extraordinary, and why she has been able to speak with such confidence to Rahm Emanuel. Because she's a coalition builder, you know, she has brought groups of people together. If public education is going to be saved, it's not going to happen because teachers protest or even teachers and parents. It will have to be school leaders, school administrators who decide to stand up for what they know is good for the students, instead of seeing themselves as managers and recipients, you know, the pipeline through which policy flows. And we're seeing more of that now, too, and I find that really encouraging, seeing superintendents there's an amazing school superintendent, John Kuhn, who teaches in a little town in West Texas, who took a group of people and stood on the steps of the State House in Austin and said, "Send us those kids that you don't want. We'll teach them." Huh. And we need more people like John Kuhn to speak out against this, and Karen Lewis, who has done effectively the same thing, brought together different groups of people who see this situation looming.
Hmm. Well, good for them. You have a blog.
I do.
And you've had this blog for a while, I think.
Yeah, 7 years.
Uh-huh.
In two different locations.
And its title is?
Teacher in a Strange Land.
Yeah. Which we've just been describing.
Yes. Yeah. I'm a big science fiction reader, and, of course, Robert Heinlein's Stranger in a Strange Land. And I was thinking of a title for the blog, and I ran Teacher in a Strange Land by several people, and none of them were particularly impressed, but I liked it so much. I kept it, and things have since I started writing it, have gotten only stranger.
That's true. I can imagine. Yes. I mean, you write about a number of things,
uh-huh.
a lot of, and you do this weekly, I believe, or monthly, or...
Yeah, I'm supposed to write 6 a month with the contract that I have right now. I am blogging right now for Education Week in their teacher division, and that's a really nice place to be because a lot of people read Education Week, and so I get a good following there, and...
Do you want to give the address so people can read it as well?
Yeah, the easiest way to find it is to Google Teacher in a Strange Land, and that's the easiest way to find it.
Yeah, you touch many subjects, I suppose, just whatever's coming along.
Uh-huh. I have a file on my desktop, on my computer, where I tuck interesting articles that I've read or news stories and everything from the really silly, you know, like dress codes, things that aren't terribly important in the big scheme of things, but often make a huge impact, all the way to, you know, federal policy. And it's really hard to predict what will draw a crowd and a lot of comments and retweets. Sometimes the things that I have tossed off, written very quickly, you know, in a half an hour and put up, turn out to be great conversation starters, and other things that I labor over and see as a masterpiece kind of sink like a stone. But I love it. It's there are a lot of people who would like to blog for Education Week, so I feel very blessed to be there.
And I'm sure they're blessed to have you as well.
Yeah. I have a lot of female readers and a lot of people who always read my blog, and if they're going to share it on Facebook or, you know, share mm-hmm. it with friends, mm-hmm. Most of them are women.
Strange.
Well, and I think it's...
That was tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah, I think women like...
Well, I think we like women's perspective, by and large.
We do, and...
As a feminist,
I have a workshop that I do. I've done it in 3 or 4 states on becoming a teachers who want to blog. It's always fun to do it, and every time I've done it, there'll be... maybe 20 people there, and most of them will be women. You know, 15 will be women and 5 will be men, and the women will be anxious, and they will say, you know, should I use my real name? You know, do you ever talk about your students? And they're so thoughtful, and they have these really good questions, and the men just want to know, how do you get more people to read? You know, how do you build your numbers? How can you check and see how you're doing? And
this is such a really crisis time in so many areas, and certainly in teaching and students and schools and school closures and all of it. Do you see your role changing, or do you see yourself taking a role in protests, or what's ahead?
Since I officially retired, and I did that because I wanted to change roles. I wanted to have time to read more about education and to be part of a public conversation. And I've given some thought to running for office, something, mm-hmm. Starting local, and given some thought to writing a book. I have a writing partner. He's a retired school superintendent, and we have written several articles together and submitted them to magazines and things, but we're thinking about a book. But I find that I can just be helpful for people who are trying to figure out how to deal with this, with what's happening to public education. And I can give you an example. I realize I'm kind of casting about, but this kind of thing has happened to me increasingly, and it just happened within the last 2 days. I got an email from someone I've never met before, a young man who is in his 20s and a father, and he's a school board member. He was just elected last year at a school board, a local school in Michigan. The school is struggling, and their superintendent is suggesting that they become a charter school, that they just sell out, they're in financial trouble, so, to let a charter management come in and just take over the district. And he said, I don't know what to do. I don't know the research. I don't know, who can help me. And he contacted me because he read the blog.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been in contact with him all day today, pulling resources together for him, things he can hand out to other board members, talking with him about forming coalitions, who else will help you with this work, who's on your side, who will stand to benefit if you do become a charter, who will stand to lose. This is not paid work, He can't afford a consultant. He just doesn't know what to do, and he found me and said, can you help me?
Wow.
So I would like to do that, and I'd like to continue doing that. I'm not sure there is any one organization that is speaking right now for public schools, and I think it looks so different state to state and, location to location, city to city, that this is really going to have to be a grassroots effort to keep schools alive. And so if I can help anybody, that's kind of what I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That sounds so meaningful at this point.
It's
really important. I think, yes, like the Occupy movement, but we have to be a teacher's movement.
Yes.
and to have other people know you and know that you have all those capacities, resources to suggest.
Yeah.
So he did find you.
He did. And
so that's good news.
And I can offer some things. So
I'm sure you can.
I'm happy to do that.
Right. Well, I think of, wasn't it Newark that the teachers and the students walked out?
Yes.
That's very exciting, I think.
Yeah.
I'm thrilled by stuff like that.
Yes, I am too, and it's happening more and more. I was part of the planning team, the executive board, for the Save Our Schools March a couple of years ago in the summer, and that drew some attention. But I know that there is not, again, one single event or one single organization that's going to turn the tide on this. It will happen. It'll pop up in all 50 states and, you know, all local newspapers and all radio shows in Willits, California. People will be talking about it, and that's how change happens. A window eventually forms through which, you know, something can change.
Yes. Well, Nancy Flanagan, it's been wonderful having you. Our time is coming to a close. Your blog site again is Teacher in a Strange Land.
Yes.
Just Google it.
Google it. Yeah.
All right. Thank you again.
Thank you, Janie.
Okay. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Shaping life before.